Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, welcome to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine, where this week we are joined by Max Moyer. Max has just started a new fantasy series, Zodak, The Last Shielder, is the first book in the Tempest Rising series. We discuss the very detailed specifics of world building, also why you don't have to be completely original, and you can hear how he works with his brother to create the world.
He will write a very dense, very academic, encyclopedic account of a carnivorous moss that's found in a wood. And he does it by typewriter. He loves to do it by typewriter. So I've got a bunch of these files from the encyclopedia. Yidwian is the name of our world. We've got these different entries. So that's the kind of material we pull on. And again, it's always evolving. You know, the maps we're creating, it's easy to do a sort of 30,000 foot map of the whole continent, but if you're working with the scale, and that's been an interesting exercise too, is really nailing down scale. But when you're working with a scale, an area that's as big as France, when you zoom in, there are a million things going on that you don't see from that high level view, that if you're really going to create an authentic world, there's towns, there's villages, there's smaller cities, there's all sorts of interactions at a micro level all the way up to the macro level. So there's a lot more to create even than we've started creating.
There is more with Max in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to the show. This is the podcast where we take a look through an author's working day. We see how, when, and where they get to work. How do they give themselves the best chance of getting an idea from their head onto the page? And this week, we are brought to you by the new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? Now, if you love crime writing and storytelling, which I reckon you probably do, and you enjoy a podcast, which I imagine you do, it's right up your street, really. Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? It's all about a murder back in 1983, completely unsolved. It's regarded as one of Scotland's most gruesome unsolved cases. Until perhaps now. The killer is still on the run, but a few months ago, the police announced the biggest step forward in this case for the past 40 years. And you can be there, front and centre, right in the middle, across 5 episodes told through a mixture of documentary and drama. The series goes into the very centre of a live investigation, with interviews from the senior investigating officer, forensic scientists, psychologists, as well as family members and friends of the victim. It's a classic whodunit case that is still baffling the police after 40 years. There are a lot of true crime podcasts out there. If you're a fan, this is a really brilliant twist on them. Just slightly tweaking the way that they're done. It puts you right in the heart of things as the case is still unfolding. Can you try and uncover who is the Cheese Wire Killer? You can find the series now, listen to the whole lot wherever you get your shows, search for Who is the Cheese Wire Killer, and try and solve one of Scotland's most famous murders ever. This week on the show, we're chatting to Max Moyer. Now, 30 years ago, while Max was playing Dungeons & Dragons with his brother, he had an idea for a fantasy board game, which became a fantasy series. He started writing it through well, comics and then novels, and then life got in the way. And he stopped thinking about it for 18 years until one day he just started typing again. Now, I get a lot of requests over at writersroutine.com for fantasy authors, for world building. Sounds so grand, so huge. It's what we all do when we write books, but in fantasy it just adds a layer of complexity, I think. So I've got you a fantasy author who is publishing a book, written a prequel, got big plans of where the series will go, where it will take him, where he will take his characters, maybe spin-offs, maybe new books, maybe merch, maybe board games as well. And I'm excited for you to hear everything. Now, I'll level with you. I am not much of a fantasy reader, so my touch points are usually the classics, J.R.R. Tolkien from Lord of the Rings, George R.R. Martin from Game of Thrones. But I really do think in here we get into the specifics of fantasy, talking about creating a world, how much of it comes from an organic place, how much of it is forced. If you design the world, does it give you an easy way out as a writer? We get into the minutiae of it all, the accents, whether the plot comes before the world, how you work with an audiobook narrator. Also, you can hear why things don't have to be completely original. And Max is busy. He works in law, running a team of people. He's helped to bring up a family. And now he's got back to work on a passion project he started years and years ago. He has big plans for the series. Well, that's the idea anyway. And we chat all about it. And I think there are lots to take away from this for any writer. And if you're into fantasy and trying to build a world over hundreds of pages and many books and hopefully a lot more besides, I really think this will help. There's a lot going on, so let's dive into it with Max. And we start with what he sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
Sure. So usually when I'm sitting down to write, it's dark outside. So the view isn't particularly inspiring. It is either in the corner of my bedroom, with my wife asleep, I've set up a little table, or depending on whether we've had a child migrate into our room in the middle of the night, I might go to a different room of the house. But usually it's dark, and I'm facing a wall, dialed into whatever I'm writing.
Okay, so you've got the wall. Now, I know because of the nature of what it is you write, things can get quite imaginative, like quite grand scale. Have you got anything on the wall that kind of leads you to where you need to be?
Zero on the wall. I do like writing in interesting locations, and the family has a house up in the mountains, so I will take advantage of those vistas when I can. But my regular routine, it's really to eliminate distractions. I'll have open different windows with maps and reference materials and things, but typically it's just sort of heads down and tapping the mind's eye, if you will.
And you've got, you mentioned the maps that you have open. Is there a grand plan? Is there an intricate spreadsheet with what needs to happen when, where your characters are off to?
Yeah, so the backstory of the world I write into is kind of interesting. My brother and I, as kids, started creating this world. So 30 years ago plus, we began kind of telling stories in this world. It actually began, I was at a friend's house, and he introduced me to this thing called Dungeons and Dragons. And I came home and didn't have any of the books and dice and whatever, but told my brother about this cool game, and we started playing with pads of paper and a pen, and that was it. So we for years played this game. We imaginatively named Walking Down a Hall, because you usually would start walking down a hall. And over time, we kind of built out this world and learned many years later, fairly recently, that what we were doing is called world building to a lot of people. But that's what we started, and it has not been necessarily linear. I'd say different points in our lives, we've kind of come back together and had a flurry of creativity. And at this point, we do have a chronology that tracks some of the big things that have happened in the history of this world. We have a map. And then through my writing, which has been a focusing of our creative efforts in this world, we've been forced to come up with some of what you would expect in the world building and understanding who lives where, and as well as some of the histories and backstories.
So let's take some time on the world building, because I very rarely chat to someone who's had to do it to such a scale as you, who has written just the first novel, really, or has published just the first novel. Like, you might expect it from someone like, I don't know, George R. R. Martin, who is 8 books down or however many it is. So I know this began when you were young. When you first started to think seriously about world building, how much of it was naturally organic as opposed to, oh, we need someone that does this, so let's build a house for them here? Like, how much just of this world naturally built up as you were thinking?
Yeah, good question. When we were kids, it was all amorphous and you just sort of pulled whatever you could out of your mind, and that became part of the game. In college, my brother and I decided we were going to try to turn this into first it was a video game. We wrote a video game proposal that we thought would be a really cool way to translate our world into a game. And shocking, none of the big studios took us up on that. Then we morphed to a board game. We thought it would be fun to do a board game. So Zodak, The Last Shielder, my debut novel, actually started as a starter story for the board game. It was going to be 7 to 10 pages long and get you started, know who your character is, and you start playing the board game. At 100 pages, I thought, gosh, maybe I'm writing a book. So it happened fairly organically. But then over time, he writes some, I would write. We would do it for fun, and we'd do it, you know, as a creative exercise. But when it translated into the book, that's when it got real. That's when we had to make sure we were being consistent. And I would say some of the amorphous creativity began to solidify a bit. And so even in writing the book, I went back and forth and would have him look at sections. He'll read what I've written, and we want it now to be consistent to the world we're building. I put out a prequel novella in October, which takes place 200 years earlier, same world, some of the same geographies that show up in the book. It's an unrelated story. But again, that was another exercise in figuring out how to make sure we're consistent in our creativity and that it aligns with the current story we're telling. So we have entered a new phase of this world building process. There's not necessarily a master plan. We have some of the elements of the world building nailed down, but also leaving it open to further creativity.
Now, this question might come off as a bit judgy, and I sincerely don't mean it to. I just can't think of any other way to word it. Like, you mentioned you started this process with your brother when you were really young. Now you are like a dad. You got 4 kids. You run a law firm. Like, you are an adult. Talking with your brother and thinking, you know what I'm going to do? Let's create this world and let's make it properly real. Like, it's just a really interesting contrast in something that is inherently quite young, which world building naturally is, I think, to you doing it as a proper adult. How did those two things marry up?
Sure. Yeah, no, it has been a fascinating exercise. We love it. We continue to love it. You do have to buy into what you're doing. And for me, there's also stigma that some people have as it comes to the genre or to fantasy. And you know, part of this creative process is owning what you're doing and knowing there's value in the creativity. At the end of the day, it is a backdrop to tell good stories, I think. And I'm starting to get some great reviews back on the book, but what has resonated, I think, with a lot of readers is just telling good stories about people. And that's really what we're doing. So the fantasy genre, the fantasy setting, the world we've created is fun and adds a lot of, I'd say, intrigue and depth to what we're writing. But at the end of the day, if you're not telling compelling stories about people and relationship and these themes, nobody cares. Well, maybe a couple people care who are just committed to reading about dragons or whatever. But really, that's what this exercise is. And so understanding as a fantasy author, what I'm doing is not too different from what another author is doing. It's just in a different setting. I mean, that's a big piece of it. But we still love doing this together and being creative. The ultimate vision is not just the books, but that we create a world that people are invested in and can kind of continue to put out content. Maybe the board game rears its head again one day, but having an audience that is eager to learn more about these characters they've invested in.
All right, just in the space of 10 minutes, I have quickly gleaned that I do not have the mind or creativity to be able to world build like that. Can you try and talk through the process of world building? I would really struggle to come up with something that hasn't been invented before. So doing my own version of Westeros or my own version of the Shire or Hobbiton, like, how have you sat there through the years and thought, oh, okay, I need a water sprite. I need a dragon here. How forceful is this creativity of what you need?
Yeah, that's a great question. What inevitably you do, or I have done in this process is both to borrow from existing tropes, existing body of work. So our world has creatures you would recognize from other works. It has elves and has dwarves and it has, giants and half giants, things pulled from fantasy, pulled from folklore. But then also we have unique creatures and some unique aspects that is sort of that hardcore world building. You're literally just pulling something out of your head. And again, some of this is source material we've created over the years. And then whenever I'm writing, there's new things I'm creating as I go. To me, the balance is give people who enjoy the genre things they recognize and things they know, but also, present new things that make this world unique. And they're there for a reason and a purpose. So it's a little bit of both. And so as an example, we, as I mentioned, have a chronology of what's happened over the years. It's all unique to our world. The great goblin invasion happened, decades or centuries ago, and that has shaped some of what's happened in the world. The prequel I wrote had a little bit of a Game of Thrones feel to it. So it was political intrigue and there was kings and governors vying for position and power. So then you get more into what does the world building look like from a political view as well. And that brings up a whole different aspect to the chronology. So it's a bit of using the skeleton we've created and then adding to it as we go.
I imagine this might be a problem you'll find down the line. Is there a worry that because the world that the characters are in are your own, you can kind of solve any problem that's thrust at them? If your character needs a quick escape, it's like, oh, there's the Valley of Infinite Waterfalls where you could just run, that kind of thing, is there a worry that by setting the boundaries of lore yourself, you might make it too easy for you to be flexible around staying true to the story?
That can certainly happen. It's funny. I was reading some correspondence with an ARC reader this morning, a gentleman in his 70s who has really enjoyed reading some of what I've been putting out. And he specifically cited that point. He said, I like that you don't just take the quick exit, the easy way out by creating something that is a convenient escape to the problem you find yourself in. And part of that, I think, is also just good storytelling. Our world is a low magic world. It's high fantasy, kind of low magic. So it does feel a bit like the Tolkien, where there isn't a ton of magic, maybe even a little less so than there, but there's enchanted relics and there's runes and there's things happening beyond the eye. But, I've learned a lot about world building since I started this journey, and boundaries are important as the powers. So making sure you know what it costs a character to use a special power, where that power or ability ends and its costs are just as important. So exactly like you said, you're not taking advantage of the system and losing some of the drama in the struggle and the conflict that we have in real life, because we have our own boundaries and constraints that dictate how that works.
Tell us how does it exist outside of the actual story? Like, what documentation? Do you have maps? Do you have Bibles, atlases?
So we have chronologies and we have histories. We have a number of sort of short writings. My brother is a writer as well in his own right. So he's got his stories. It's, you know, one thing he loves doing, which is sort of funny, is we have these knowledge keepers called the Baruch monks in our world, and they sort of keep all of the knowledge. So he will write a very dense, very academic, encyclopedic account of a carnivorous moss that's found in a wood. And he does it by typewriter. He loves to do it by typewriter. So I've got a bunch of these files from the encyclopedia. Yidwian is the name of our world. Won't try to spell it, but we've got these different entries. So that's the kind of material we pull on. And again, it's always evolving. You know, the maps we're creating, it's easy to do a sort of 30,000 foot map of the whole continent. But if you're working with the scale, and that's been an interesting exercise too, is really nailing down scale. But when you're working with a scale, an area that's as big as, you know, France, when you zoom in, there are a million things going on that you don't see from that high level view, that if you're really going to create an authentic world, there's towns, there's villages, there's smaller cities, there's all sorts of interactions at a micro level all the way up to the macro level. So there's a lot more to create even than we've started creating.
We'll talk about the actual plot in just a second, but touching on that point about scale and knowing what's happening, when your protagonist Zodak is doing something in the north of the island, as an author, how aware are you of what different, completely unique tribes perhaps will be doing in the south of the island? Do you need an awareness of all of that?
I think it helps with consistency. Now, for better or for worse, both the prequel novella and Zodak take place in, we call it the Midlands, but even more focused in, you know, a 32nd of the landmass. So we haven't had to figure out every detail for the initial book, because he never gets to the north of the map in this story. But there are people from all over, and what has been fascinating is also translating this, because we're releasing in audiobook and Audible as well, but it's been translating this into voice. So one thing we had to do, which we never even really thought about for the writing, was we created recently a dialects map. And we said, basically, people who are from this area, we want them to sound like this, people from this area. And that was purely to inform the narrator on how he should make these people sound, because suddenly it wasn't just on the page. We now had to make them sound like something in order to distinguish. And so that was another layer of world building that I hadn't really thought about until we got into the audiobook.
Tell us about the thought process that went into figuring out where different accents lie. How inspired were you by what tends to happen across a lot of countries, well, particularly here in the West, where if you're in the country, your dialect is quite slow and drawly, whereas if you're in a city, everything's very fast-paced, so you naturally talk like that. How inspired were you by real-life traditions and practices?
Yeah, we had have a fabulous narrator. His name is Dallin Bradford, and exceedingly talented in doing accents, which I guess is the table stakes for even having this conversation. You know, we wanted them to be understandable. You know, there's some criticism of how works like, you know, Star Wars will make these people sound Asian and these people sound. So doing it in a way that's not distracting from the story, first and foremost. You don't want to pull people out of the story. But there is regional. So there's regional dialects that we worked on. But also, to your point, within a city, you can have the educated, the uneducated. You can have folks from the country. So it starts out in a provincial village outside of the city. Those people sound different than the folks who are in the city. So it, again, was a balancing act of what lends authenticity to this process? What would these folks sound like? Yeah, if they were out in the country versus in the city, what would they sound like if they had been sent away to this elite knowledge institute versus working on the farm. And then if they came from up north, if they came from over the mountains to the west, if they came from one of these regional tribes that doesn't interact with the cities, all those kind of questions came into it. And then mapping that over into accents we generally recognize and aren't too distracting, but make it sound different. So as an example, we thought, oh, maybe these people could have some sort of Irish brogue. And again, to our narrator Dallin's credit, he came back with a voice sample and asked us if we wanted it to sound, you know, more regional from this group, or did we want it to sound, you know, more Dublin or more Cork? And it has all these different intonations within an Irish accent that gives us a lot to choose from.
I imagine a tricky thing about writing fantasy, because, and I'm stereotyping here, painting with a broad brush, but so much of it is focused on the idea of a quest, right? And I know so much of fiction is that anyway, but maybe in slightly different zones. Yeah, when you have invented a world, when you have your protagonist, when there is a quest against something dark and evil, how tricky is it to not find yourself directly thinking of the stories who have done these things so well before you, stuff like Lord of the Rings?
That's a good question. I mean, it goes to the creation of a story. You know, one thing I have learned in this process is, A, it doesn't have to be completely original. In fact, leaning on some of the tropes is what really connects with a genre you're writing into. So there's actually an expectation of following some of the well-beaten path of folks who have gone before. I also think, just sort of philosophically, you know, good stories that draw people in tend to follow similar arcs, and you know, maybe there are a few different prototypes for that, but just generally speaking, you know, we certainly have embraced the good versus evil, you know, mounting challenge, conflict, and truth and light against the, you know, the darkness. So that shows up in a bajillion stories across all genres, right? You want to be careful that it doesn't look like you're reskinning, you know, an exact replica of another story, another book. The flip side is, I think people resonate with this concept of a greater evil out there, and the struggle and conflict that comes with trying to bring goodness and light into that space. So I'd say we're pulling on a lot of familiar themes and threads, and that is what connects with people. So it's a balance of not shying away from what people are looking for and readers are expecting to see, and also offering fresh stories, fresh perspectives, and new characters.
Those themes and the paths that have been walked before that you mentioned, what was the studying that you did to know those? Was there much thoughtful analysis of things that have come before, like what journey your hero goes on? Or is it a case that you've just read a lot? I've read a lot of these books.
I think we're all exposed to so many stories, whether it's books, whether it's movies, whether it's shows. I mean, there is constant retreading of themes in a culture that is sort of saturated with some sort of story, often through entertainment, and the stories we all experience in our lives. So there was not a careful cataloging of prior fantasy books or movies. It was more, you know, writing from a center that is interested and wants to kind of pull on, like, a redemptive story is very important to me. And some of these genres, I think, have been played with in sometimes in not so effective ways, where getting too creative with and kind of going too far outside of the bounds of classic storytelling doesn't always work. But yeah, you want to be inventive and creative. And I think, yeah, for me, it's been fairly organic writing good stories and placing them in this this interesting backdrop.
Is there a worry that you could be almost too inventive and too tied to your characters? I mean, if you think about George R. R. Martin, author of Game of Thrones, I think, well, I imagine famously can't finish the book that everyone's waiting for because he is too wedded to this situation. Like, and he has painted far too big of a world that he's struggling to tie it together as a pantser. I don't think he really plots his novels. Like, how much are you thinking about if you're inventing this massive universe, you still need it within the boundaries of the stories that you want to tell and to keep it slightly simple for yourself?
Well, you've touched on a few things, many of which bring me some level of anxiety as a first-time author. So Zodak, as I mentioned, started as this starter story. I mean, my confession is I started it when my oldest daughter was just born and I was in law school. And she's now in university and is 19, so you can do the math. But, you know, it did sit in a drawer for a decade or more during that part. So I'm fairly confident book two won't take me 19 years to write. But, you know, you look around at some of the greats, the George R. R. Martins of the world, and replicating this process and doing it in a way that continues to produce compelling material. I mean, that kind of thing is always on probably any author's mind, certainly a debut author like myself. And you don't know exactly what people will respond to and how that story will take shape. I started as a pure pantser, again, because I wasn't really writing a book. I've converted a bit over to more of an outliner. And I do know where this trilogy is going to end. So I have a pretty clear view onto that. And the question will be what happens after that. So I mentioned a prequel novella. I'm planning to do a novella between each novel as well. So I'm working on a backstory to one of the characters in Zodak as a new novella that I'll plan to release this year as well. So continuing to write, continuing to engage in the craft, I think is extremely important, both as a new writer who's trying to figure out what this whole thing looks like. You mentioned I have a fairly full plate, so balancing it all is top of mind as well, and just being realistic about what it takes to get this book from start to finish, which I haven't done in a typical way yet, is part of what I think about.
Like you talking about the prequels and filling in some of the gaps of different characters, I imagine a fantasy story like this can be quite fruitful. Like you said that you've got this trilogy in mind. Yeah, I would imagine that, you know, Zodak will meet characters along the way, and then that leads you to be able to tell their stories and then someone else's stories. And then in this universal building, there are always opportunities for different avenues to go down. How much are you thinking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the novella format lends itself to that. So Ryan Cahill is a well-known indie author. I think I got the idea from him that this cadence, and again, part of it is I'm not 100% sure exactly how fast I can put out books. So I want to make sure there are things coming out as I go. And that's part of the reason the novellas appeal to me. It's also just fun to explore different characters. So the backstory that I'm writing now, Badu is the name of the character. He comes from a different city. It's over the mountains. It's segregated. It has its own backstory, how it came to be, has its own kind of power structure. And for reference, it's the language is, it's all English, but it's inspired by Turkish words. So that's kind of the flavor the city has. So that in itself has been fun to explore a different part of the world that I hadn't touched yet in any of the writing. So it's a journey for me, and it is a journey for the readers. And ultimately, you know, you see Star Wars, you see Brandon Sanderson, you see some of these iconic examples of this, but creating a world people are invested in and want to learn more about what happened back then or what happened 1,000 years ago, or what's going to happen to this person, and keeping those stories interesting and relevant. We'll see what the appetite is like for that after the trilogy, but that's the vision of you've drawn people in and you have a conduit just to tell great stories and you know, provide this creativity to people who want to consume it and participate in it.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Someone out there knows who did it.
There's people out there just keeping quiet, not telling us what they know.
My expectation would be
somebody out there knows something.
That somebody would know about it other than just the killer.
I firmly believe
someone out there knows who did it.
Somebody would know about it.
Somebody knows who did it.
Somebody out there knows something.
Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? Listen to the full series now, wherever you get your podcasts.
You can hear every single episode of that new series, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer, wherever you get your podcasts. They are sponsoring the show this week, and you can support the show next week if you like. If you've published something that has not got the fanfare, not got the plugging that I'm absolutely certain it and the work you put into it deserves, well, let me do that for you. Let me talk about it. Let me really, really push it for you. To make that happen, just support the show over on our Patreon page, patreon.com/writersroutine. While you're there, for just a couple of dollars a month, you get bonus content, there is merch, and as I say, there is even a way for your book to sponsor this show, and it doesn't require a lot. I know that times are tight, so anything that you can send over goes an extraordinarily long way. It's only me that works on this, that keeps doing everything, trying to do everything at the very least, to bring you chats with the best authors around as often as I can. And if you'd like that to continue, the best way to help out is by becoming a backer and pledging to support us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it then this week with our guest Max Moyer talking about his debut fantasy book Zodak, The Last Shielder. It's the first in the Tempest Rising series. There's also been a prequel novella out called Throneborn. It's all about Zodak, who lives a bleak life at the hands of his hateful aunt, when he gets whisked off onto a mysterious magical journey with a medallion to find his uncle in a vast unknown world. And we talk more about the novel in this part and the process of world building. You can hear about coming back to a story 18 years after leaving it. And we jump back in talking about the plot. Does it come before the world? Does the world build the plot around it? What comes first in that?
The way I have gone about this particular book is not traditional. If I were starting new now, what I think I would do is choose a time, choose a place, choose a story, and then make sure it aligns. My brother's name is Eli. Make sure Eli and I are aligned on sort of the meta concepts that are implicated by the story. And I have done that. So he has seen the outlines for book two and book three. He knows where it's going, and we're sort of aligned on what that means for the world. you know, it is a trilogy where the world is at stake. So it's not a self-contained story. I think it, again, if it, let's say trilogy one is done and I'm starting on a new series, then it would be great to position it somewhere, you know, in line with the chronology, in part because I love the connections between characters and things you read that connect you to the world. You know, quick example, the prequel novella is called Throneborn, and one of the main characters is King Trimidian. I have had a couple of folks who have been ARC readers for Zodak point out a typo where one of the characters calls it a Trimidius morning. Well, it's not a typo. It's just what they say, and it's a throwback to King Trimidian, who doesn't show up in the book, but he shows up in a, you know, in a prequel 200 years earlier, such that people in the region still use his name as an adjective. So those are the kind of little threads you love to weave between stories in a world. And so more so than having a narrative that has to follow something we've already created, it's more working within the bounds of what has been created.
So let's talk about this debut then, Zodak, The Last Shielder. And I'm doing things all out of order here. I normally would have asked you about like your day and your writing routine, but we will push that back because I'm into it. So Zodak, The Last Shielder, you said that this is, it came to you in a slightly different way. Just tell us about the first moment that the actual plot for this novel came into your head.
So disclaimer, again, it was 19 years ago. but it started, again, as a starter story. So I knew I was creating a character in the span of 10 pages that was going to set up who he was and what he was doing. In truth, probably quickly abandoned that as I got into writing, completely pantsing the idea. But it's about, an orphan. Zodak is an orphan, and he grows up in this backwater town with a terrible family situation, and he's called into this epic quest. So right from the beginning, he gets swept up into something far bigger than himself. One thing I did in writing it is sort of unfold the world for the reader as it's unfolding for him. There are a few obvious tells that he's not on Earth, that he's in a secondary world. But it's pretty normal to start with. And as the story progresses, it's sort of peeling back the onion for him and the reader and exposing some of the world building as we go, which was a fun exercise. And I think for folks who are not hardcore fantasy readers, having a complicated magic system explained on page two is sometimes overwhelming. This is more of an ease into the world.
Let's talk about that gap that you had. So you start this and then 18 years later you pick it up. Can you just expand on why you stopped and also what made you think I might give that another go?
So I wrote through, I want to say it was 100 or 150 pages. I had a story and I had at that point begun to think where it was going to go. For fun and to get the family involved, I printed out that story. I made a homemade cover, glued it all together in my basement, very rudimentary, and handed it out to my immediate family to read. I actually shudder a little bit when I go back and read what I wrote back then, sort of first time ever doing this. That was law school. I went to a large law firm, and as an associate in a large law firm, at that point I had two kids. There just wasn't time for it. I had no time for it. So it took a backseat, as did some other things in my life during that period. There was always a nagging voice in the back of my mind wanting to finish this story at some point. There's actually a Family Guy episode where Stewie is the highly intelligent, sarcastic baby character is pushing the dog, asking about his novel and how he'd been working on it for 3 years. And it's a funny scene, and his voice keeps getting higher and higher. My brother would often like throw that out at me. how's the novel going? Eh? It's been 3 years, huh? How's the plot, huh? Happens to really character arcs, huh? And we joke about it. It also remained in the back of my mind so much so that I told him it. Finally, I'm going to be free of that voice in about a month. So the truth is, it's always been a creative outlet, and I've wanted to return to it. So as soon as I was able, I picked it up again and kind of went headlong into that journey. What I brought to my editor, because I did hire a developmental editor, which is a great move, is, you know, a shadow of what it ended up being, in part because you cobble together a story over that many years, having not written one before, it probably needs an overhaul.
When you revisited what you had worked on 18 years ago, how much had changed about, I guess, your writing and how you thought about your world and the world, and how apparent was that?
I had a realization recently, just what that time represented. So I'm 45 now. So I was in my 20s 18 years ago. And that sort of struck me, just the different person I am now. I mean, writing aside, I haven't diligently been honing my craft for 18 years, but a lot had changed just in my life, and in the person I am now is just looks different. Like anybody than the person you look like almost 20 years ago. So life experience, I think, has certainly affected the way I write. And I have read books on writing and done a lot more writing than I had then. So it is interesting. I had that epiphany. I mentioned to my wife, like, hey, you know what? This started when I was in my 20s, and I'm a different person than I was. So it certainly evolves. The book needed a overhaul, which helped. So I did a lot of writing not 18 years ago. And a lot of what started is still in the book. You know, some of the story that initially I wrote is still intact, but it's a very different feeling to it. Force myself to write 2 days a week at least. Wednesday mornings and Saturday mornings are the time I cut out. So midweek, and then on Saturday, usually I'm up at 5. I've set the coffee machine the night before, and just heads down, put my headphones on, got my Bach radio going, and try to just push forward, in write as much as I can. And some days are more productive than others. In that respect, I'll then try to go back and read through what I've written sort of more as a reader, in off hours or at a different time. A routine I initially had was reading everything I had written out loud to my wife. So I have an audience, and when you read something out loud, you catch all sorts of things you didn't catch when you wrote. What always amazes me is, in those, and I don't know if it's sort of the flow or it's a 5 a.m. and I haven't woken up or what, but I'm often a little surprised to read what I've written, even that morning. It's like, oh, right, yeah, I remember that happened. And you almost lose track of it. So I take that as a good sign that I'm in a creative building space in those dark hours, that when I come back to it, in an editing hat on or something, I can actually even appreciate some of the writing I've done early in the morning.
What constitutes a good writing session for you for those two times a week? Are you, is it a amount of time you get done? Is it a word count thing?
It's not necessarily a word count. I mean, when you finish a scene that's powerful or has the potential to be, I think it just, there's a feeling there that is special. And I tend to be sort of a layering writer in that often I'll go back and layer in more details. Maybe I'll layer in some internal dialogue, emotions, things like that. But you know, you have some good thoughts in an outline when I sit down to actually write it and write it out, and you're capturing some of the dialogue and some of the nuance. A good writing day for me is having crafted a good scene. And sometimes you get through a couple, but it's not a fixed word count as much as translating what you had, this idea, which you knew was a good idea in the outline, into a written word. Is that's a good day in my mind.
Now, because you have quite grand plans of what you want to get done, you know, the three books in the trilogy, the prequels that go with it, hopefully more. There's even talk of a board game down the line. Yet you're writing, because you're busy, you're writing twice a week. How planned, and we've discussed plotting and pantsing earlier, how planned and focused do those sessions need to be, because you need to get stuff done?
Well, the life of an indie author is also something different that I've been learning over the last few months. And there were, admittedly, it was a bit of a shock to the system when sometime last fall I had to shift gears from not just writing to keeping up the writing and now doing all this other stuff, which was all new to me. So, you know, building the website and building a newsletter and advertising, social media, like all this other work. So it's a great question. I also acknowledge that this is probably, you know, a harder season to do a lot of writing than it will probably be in the future. I was talking with a guy at a conference whose kids are out of the house, and he said, well, you know, if you're able to do this now, just wait, because, you know, if you stick to it, you're going to have a lot more time, a lot more opportunity to write more. Now, who knows? Tomorrow's not promised. So for now, it is do what I can with the time I have. I really enjoy it. And it's extremely fulfilling when someone who's read something I've written comes back and has connected with the writing. So I try not to overthink that too much, which is why I'm not even really considering anything beyond the trilogy in terms of any sort of hard commitment. If I get to the end of the trilogy and there's a couple dozen people who like my writing, then maybe that served its purpose. And if there's a grand following, then maybe that means it's time to write more.
And that is it for this week's episode of Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Max Moyer for coming on the show. The new book is Zodak, The Last Shielder, the first in the new Tempest Rising series. There is also that prequel novella, Throneborn, which is out right now. If you enjoy fantasy, I really hope you got something out of that show. And I've been asked a lot, as I say, about fantasy authors and world builders. I hope that skimmed some of the surface for you. You can always suggest authors that you'd like me to chat to. Use the contact page at writersroutine.com. If you can, I'd really love it for you to support the show at patreon.com/writersroutine. It helps me keep bringing you these chats with some of the best authors around as often as I can. You get bonus episodes, there's loads of stuff, merch on there, and all of that. We will be back next week with a brand new episode of the show. In the meantime, if you're celebrating, have a very happy Easter, and I will see you in a few days. Until then, bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.